Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2006. A prize-winning foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Geraldine Brooks spent 6 years covering the Middle East through wars, insurrections, and the upheavals of resurgent fundamentalism. Out of that experience, she wrote Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. In that book, she pulled back the veil on the private lives of Islamic women, creating a cultural portrait that still remains the subject's standard text. It's a really marvelous book. I highly recommend it, and everything she's written. In 2001, she made the leap to fiction. Based on actual events, The Year of Wonders revisits a village in the English countryside whose residents agreed to quarantine themselves for fear of spreading the plague. The novel glitters, The New Yorker raved, calling the timely drama a deep imaginative engagement with how people are changed by catastrophe. I could not put it down. In her most recent novel, March, she uses America's Civil War as her frame, planting a famous but deeply mysterious literary figure at its center, Mr. March, the absent father, in Louisa May Alcott's classic Little Women. The book we just heard tonight was just shortlisted for the British Book Award, so you can congratulate Geraldine on that. The book is a rich reimagining of the nation's political and literary foundations and a perceptive, though speculative, portrait of Bronson Alcott, Louisa May Alcott's real-life father. She will be in conversation tonight with Carla Kaplan, who is professor of English, gender studies, and American and ethnic studies at USC, where she teaches a wide range of courses in 20th century literature and culture. Carla was last here on the Allowed series when she spoke about her book, Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters, and we have that for sale tonight also, courtesy of our library store. The New York Times wrote that Kaplan has made the letters remarkably accessible, and the book list described it as not merely a collection of letters, but a comprehensive introduction to an important American writer. She's right now working on Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. Please welcome Geraldine Brooks and Carla Kaplan.
Well, I think that if you're up for it, what I'd love to ask you to do is start by reading a piece so people get a sense of the voice of the book, which is one of the most, I think, remarkable things about this completely remarkable novel.
Okay, happy to do that. I'll just read maybe a short piece because to me, what this book is about, in part, is what happens to a marriage when one partner goes off to war, and how do lines of communication stay open? And most of the book is in the voice of Mr. March, the absent father. And as it becomes more and more difficult for him to communicate with his wife back home, he finds himself reminiscing about their relationship and going back over the details of their marriage. So I'm going to read you, if I can ever find my glasses in this messy bag here. A section from their early courtship, and this is a part where March has decided that he's very much in love with this woman, Margaret Marie Day, but he hasn't yet declared himself. And she's living in the village of Concord, and he has found a reason to get himself to Concord to press his suit. And one of the things that gets me up in the morning as a historical novelist is finding out the unexpected detail. And the banner day with March was finding out that Henry David Thoreau, as well as giving us his wonderful nature writing, also gave us the variable hardness pencil. So who knew that? But pencil making was the Thoreau family business. So Mr. March is actually visiting the Thoreau household when this scene takes place. And the other famous neighbor of Concord is at dinner, which is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And you may think this is a very unlikely congruence of guests, but in fact, the Alcotts and the Emersons and the Thoreaus dine together regularly. So it's actually closely hewing to fact. So this is Mr. March talking about Margaret Marie Day, who has just arrived at the Thoreau table house. After yearning for a glimpse of her, I now found myself unable to meet her eyes. She, it seemed, did not suffer so. She hailed me with a composed, "Mr. March, what an unexpected pleasure to find you here in Concord," and then turned to her hostess to apologize for her lateness, explaining rather obliquely that she had been detained by the arrival of an unexpected package. Sophia Thoreau shot her a glance full of warmth and meaning. "Is your father quite equal to managing it? You might have brought it here, you know, without any reservation." Miss Day gave a radiant smile of gratitude and embraced her friend. "Thank you, my dear. I know I can always count on you and your family in these matters." Mr. Emerson looked grave. "I hope you will not mind my venturing to express a concern, Miss Day, that you do not involve your father in this beyond his wishes or capacity, for you know the extent of your influence with him, and you know also his frail state at present. It is upon him, after all, and not upon you, that the weight of adverse consequences would fall." Her colour, already high, rose to an even deeper blush that I mistook for mortification until she commenced to speak. "Mr. Emerson," she uttered the name like a hiss, "if some in this town would take up the mantle of leadership that their positions warranted, these obligations would not be left to young women and frail old men." "My dear Miss Day, a man can only extend his active attention to a certain finite amount of claims. Yet wherever I hear the black man spoken ill of, or wherever I see a Negro person mistreated, I always feel obliged to speak in his behalf. More than that, I do not think it is presently in my power to do." "Not in your power?" She seemed unaware that she had raised her voice. Sophia and Cynthia had each drawn close to Miss Day. Standing one on either side, they half-patted, half-held her, as one would both soothe and restrain a lunging, growling dog. "Not in your power? You, who command great crowds at the Lyceum, who may write for any of a dozen eminent journals, to say that you can do no more is a sham. It is a disgrace. Worse, it is a lie." The intemperance of her attack left me breathless. Angry women generally cannot be said to show to advantage, and to see that lovely face so distorted by such a scowl as it now wore was immensely shocking to me. Who could have imagined this gently bred young woman to be so entirely bereft of the powers of self-government? I had never seen such an outburst, not even from a market wife.
I I love that passage, and I had actually marked it as one of the ones I wanted to ask you about, to ask you to talk a little more about some of the changes you made in characters that you carried over from Little Women to March. And I have to thank you, because it was only because of March that I finally read Little Women. And I had been bluffing all this time. Here I was, this feminist scholar, you know, and I had actually never read Little Women. So I don't have to bluff anymore, because I read it so that we could talk about it. And one of the things I was very struck by throughout is that Marmee is constantly describing her need to conquer her own anger. And she has that long talk with Joe, where she says to Joe, I too had, you know, problems controlling myself, and I had to learn control and restraint. And it's impossible to take that on board, because she seems to be perfection itself. She never has any problems with anger or self-control. Joe does, but Marmee doesn't. And you recreate her as someone really with an enormous well of rage. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think Louisa May, yeah, she definitely gave me license to think about what would have made a woman like Marmee lose her temper. And I thought, well, you know, she is this saintly character, so she'd lose her temper in the causes for which she believed, and abolition being one of those causes. So in that scene, of course, she is part of the Underground Railroad, and they're helping a runaway slave get to Canada. And that's the reference to the package and so forth. And that actually was part of the Alcott family's life too. Their house in Concord was a station on the Underground Railroad. So what I've done is I've taken the real character of Bronson Alcott and transposed it on the narrative arc of Little Women, in as much as Louisa May tells us anything about the father of the girls. As those of you who remember the book know, it starts on a very bleak Christmas Eve with the girls lamenting the fact that father is far away where the fighting was, and he won't be there with them for Christmas. And then basically we hear very little about him until two-thirds of the way through the book as it was originally published. Marmee gets the dramatic telegram saying he's ill in a hospital in Washington and she must come at once. And then the book as it was originally published ends with the return of the father on the following Christmas. And he goes around the room and tells each of the girls how he thinks the year has changed them, but what a year at war has done to him is left unstated. So that was the imaginative seed for the novel, to kind of imagine a year at war for a person of Bronson Alcott's abolitionist, radical, transcendentalist convictions. Of course, Bronson Alcott didn't go to the Civil War because he was in his 60s when the war broke out. But he did have strong feelings, and he did risk his life to protest the repatriation of a runaway slave. And he did get arrested a year before Thoreau for refusing to pay his taxes to the state of Massachusetts, which was a protest against Massachusetts' complicity with the slave states. So I took all those convictions and put them into the character of the father. Bronson Alcott was by no means a chaplain either. He didn't even go to church.
Yeah.
he had a much more unconventional view on religion than the one Louisa May gives to the chaplain, Mr. March, in Little Women, which of course was designed for Victorian era children and therefore had to have a certain sensibility. But in terms of Marmee, I thought that what she describes as if it's a good thing in Little Women, this kind of learning to govern herself, sounded like Victorian repression to me. So I've sort of had a bit of a play with that in the novel.
She's wonderfully shook loose. I wanted to ask you more about the sort of recreation of Bronson Alcott in the form of March. In your New Yorker piece, there's a wonderful New Yorker piece that some of you, I think, have read, that Geraldine wrote about Bronson Alcott, where I learned everything I know now about him. And you said in that piece that, let me quote this, none of Louisa May Alcott's 20th century biographers are kind to Bronson. And I wanted to talk with you about whether you felt in your recreation of him in the form of March, you're kind to him. Because he's an enormously complicated character. I'm not sure I agree with the critics who describe him as undone at the end of the novel. It seems to me one could make a case that he's being redone in a form that may be actually more hopeful in the long run or better or more complete. He's certainly weakened. But he is filled with failings and guilt and betrayals. And so do you feel you are kind to him?
I fell in love with Bronson Alcott because I have a soft spot for impractical idealists, and Bronson Alcott's sort of the definitive impractical idealist. One of the reviewers of the book actually put Bronson Alcott into a better nutshell than I managed to do. He said that if Emerson and Thoreau are the shooting stars of American idealism, then Bronson Alcott is the dark matter from which they drew their energy. And he powered others' work. But his own work, I think, was pretty remarkable. He was a radical educator who ran classrooms that would still be considered progressive today, and in his own time were really astonishing in their view of how a child learns through play and through conversation rather than by rote. Yeah. And this was at a time when teachers were still being instructed that their duty was to break the will and subdue the spirit of their charges. He thought that recess should be 4 hours long, which my son thinks is a brilliant idea. But whether I've been kind to March, the thing with idealists is if you drag the idea out into the actual field of endeavor, it's very hard to keep it pure and bright and shining because of all the messiness of human nature. And I think that that's nowhere clearer than at war. And so certainly he's a man who has very high expectations for everybody, but most of all for himself. Mm-hmm. And he finds that he's not perfect, and he's not as brave as he wants to be, and he's not infallible. And he also finds out that his ideals have costs in other people's lives. And I think I kind of modeled that not on Bronson, but more on Oliver Wendell Holmes. Because Oliver Wendell Holmes was a passionate abolitionist, and he fought at the Battle of Ball's Bluff, which is where this novel opens. And he also, you know, he had a terrible war. He was wounded 3 times and was at the Battle of the Wilderness and wounded again at Antietam. And he went to war with ardently held beliefs. And Louis Menand, I think, puts it really beautifully. He says, you know, the war not only cost him his beliefs, it cost him his belief in belief. Mm. And that's sort of what happens to March. He questions the nature of idealism and realizes that there are costs to pay, and he won't be the only one who has to pay them.
One of the things that I found so moving in the novel, out of many, is when Marmy starts really talking about, even if it's to herself, how she has had to pay those costs, that all of the costs of his idealism, and these were ideals that were shared, she had to bear. And there's that moment after she watches him and she realizes he's about to volunteer. And she tries to signal him, don't do it, and he does it. And she goes to him, and she's expected as his loving wife to show, you know, adoration for his heroism. And she takes his hand and digs her nails into it to let him know through her smile how furious she is. That is just, I thought, an incredible moment. And then later when she talks about how it was fine for him to give away all of his money, their money, to John Brown, right? But that she was the one who ended up then having to scramble to feed the girls, that she was the one who ended up having to, and I wonder, was that modeled for you on anyone in particular, or just a sort of feminist history of women paying the cost for certain kinds of idealist behavior?
I think, it was trying to get at this business of how much do you ever know another soul in a marriage, even if you live intimately in love with somebody for a number of years, you can still completely misconstrue them in very fundamental ways. So where March sees her gesture as a gesture of support and feels her clutching him as her passion, you know, she's trying to get a completely opposite message across to him, and they're missing each other completely.
Yeah. That's why I love that she's actually driving her nails into his. I think any of us who are married know that moment. We sort of lived that moment, right? You're trying to get the spouse to stop.
The swift stop. Kick under the dinner swift, table.
Exactly, exactly. The nails. My husband's looking the other way. There's a moment at the end of Little Women, again, which I now know thanks to you, where it's part of the incredible sentimentalization throughout Little Women of family. And Joe says at the very end, I do think that families are the most beautiful things in all the world. And it seemed to me that part of what you undo, not only in March, but in Year of Wonders, is that sentimentality, that sentimentalization, not just of marriages, but of the family in general. And that both books are a kind of undoing in different ways. That, and I wanted to ask you something about the way they relate to each other in undoing. So I'm sure people here also know Year of Wonders. Do you mind if I ask you something about the two in relation? I was thinking about the way in which Year of Wonders undoes some of the horror we associate with the plague by showing us the kinds of wonders or marvels that come up in the midst of total crisis, total catastrophe, total devastation, the little shining moments. Certainly Anna, her finding herself, her coming into that kind of strength, which I think we have to assume might not have happened without the horrors of the plague. And so we get this, I don't want to say it's a positive story, but we get these shining moments. And it seems to me that in March, you go in some ways in the opposite direction. You take this shining picture of marriage, this shining picture of family that Alcott tries to insist on over and over and over again in Little Women, and we get the darker moments, or what you referred to earlier as the kind of the dark matter. And I was very struck at that sort of relationship in the two novels, that one gives us the shining sort of positive moments of something we think about as one of the worst horrors in world history, and the other, in a way, does the reverse. Little Women is the sort of model of the sentimental novel, and you give constantly its underside. The reunion scene, you know, that reunion scene that's so famous that you know, even if you've never read Little Women, you know the heart-rending scene when the family is reunited and they're all clinging to his legs and they're all gathered around, and it's described over and over again as perfect happiness. And in your novel, what we get is March's thoughts, where it's not perfect happiness at all. He's so horrified at the adoration he feels he doesn't deserve, he's almost sick. He nearly faints from it. And can you talk a little bit about the sort of showing the glittery side in one novel and the dark side in the other?
Yeah, but first I just wanted to I'll share with you something that I discovered in the research of this that really shocked me, which was that for all the instant success that Little Women brought to Louisa May Alcott, and it really was a huge, she was the Dan Brown of her day. I mean, this book was an instant hit and brought wealth and comfort to this family that had been very poor for a very long time. And yet in her journal, she speaks quite disparagingly of it, and it was not her favorite book. And she felt it was a book that she wrote to satisfy her publisher's desires rather than her own. And she writes, my publisher wants a book for girls. I've never liked girls much. And it turns out that what she really did enjoy writing was her much more adult-themed stories that she wrote under pseudonyms. And fortunately for us, we've had the wonderful literary sleuthdom for about the last 15 or so years. We've been able to know what stories she did write when those pseudonyms were unearthed. And the New York Public Library collected these together in a volume. And in that volume is one of my personal favorites, which is about a young woman who experiments with hashish and then goes sailing with a young man that she doesn't know very well off Wellfleet. And in the introduction, the New York Public Library says, this story could well be re-entitled Just Say Yes. So I think that, you know, in a way she'd probably, you know, I hope that if she's up there looking down, she won't mind that I've taken some liberties and added some darker adult resonances to her children's story. But with Year of Wonders, I guess that that book was very much influenced by my experiences as a foreign correspondent for a long time in the Middle East and Africa, particularly getting to know women who had been led to expect that their lives would be very domestic and very circumscribed, and then a catastrophe found them out. And the men were gone, either they were arrested or massacred or gone off to war, and suddenly the woman had to step out of her expected role and take on responsibility for saving the family. And I saw it so many times, it was kind of a motif of my experiences in these times of crisis, where you'd see the young village girl in Eritrea who'd grown up in a society so conservative that wives were not allowed to directly address their husbands until they were addressed first, and still had to go to a menstrual tent. And that woman, yet she became a guerrilla leader and led men into battle. Another one was a Kurdish family where the woman had to lead the family under fire out of the city of Kirkuk and through the mountains, through mountain passes to bring her family to safety. And so seeing women change like that gave me the strength to imagine Anna's great change from this diffident young girl who never really expected to play an important role to sort of the person who holds the town together in the end.
She's an extraordinary character, Anna, as is Grace. Is it Clement? Grace Clement, who I think you said somewhere was modeled on Harriet Jacobs's voice?
Yeah, the character and the details of her situation are completely invented, but trying to think about how a woman like that would sound, I relied very heavily on incidents in the life of a slave girl written by herself, which is the remarkable memoir of Harriet Jacobs.
It's one of the things that comes out in particularly the final discussion between when they take the walk and Grace lets March in on some but not all of her story, which I found a really marvelous moment when she says, "I'm going to tell you some but not all." I don't think those are her words, but it's something to that effect. And they have this discussion where she's telling him things are not as they seem. He sees her as this completely moral, completely shining example. And she says, is incest, is murder moral, right? Of course, and she feels all kinds of guilt and responsibility for things arguably she's not responsible for.
But she's a little different to March. Instead of wallowing in it, she's moved on, and she said, "You know, you go on and you do the good of which you're capable for the people, you know, come in your way." And that's how she, you know, she's taken the terrible circumstances that she rightly or wrongly believes that she has some moral culpability for, but she doesn't wallow in it, whereas he does. He's always trying to think, why was I not more perfect?
And he describes himself as having been a man of moral certainty, losing his moral certainty. Do you see that for him as a good loss? One of the things I was so struck by in both Year of Wonders and March are all of the people who have to face these extraordinary moral questions. In Year of Wonders, the town actually deciding at its own peril to self-sequester, to self-quarantine. It's an extraordinary moral choice. And as it turns out, right, the reasons for it themselves may be quite muddy and complicated, that there may be some selfish reasons, right, on the part of the minister, that he was encouraging that his marriage isn't what it seems. when March has made this great moral decision to go off to war, Marmee says to him, this was pride. There's a marvelous one-page speech. It's almost a page long where she gives him this sort of counter, and she says, this was your pride. You did this for pride. And I wondered if you felt about him that his losing his moral certainty by the end is a good thing.
I think that's for everybody to decide for themselves. I'm not sure I know the answer myself, but because I guess, you know, I was writing this book and the drumbeats of the war in Iraq were very loud in the background as I was finishing it. Mm. And even though the case for war was not made on moral grounds, as somebody who'd been in Iraq during the first Gulf War and been with the Kurds during their uprising and been with them also when that uprising was betrayed by a fairly feckless U.S. foreign policy decision-making at that time, I did feel very strongly that, you know, we had left these people in an intolerable situation, and so many people died that need not have. And so you could see how you can get sucked into thinking you can right injustice with war, but it never works. Mm. And it seems like it's a lesson we have to learn over and over again, that you can't right injustice because war will bring more injustice in its wake.
I know that one of the terms in which the novel keeps getting talked about is as a recreation, as a historical recreation, as a historical novel. I think you said in one interview you think you'll always write historical novels, but it was very clear to me in reading March, this is also an anti-war novel, that this was a novel that had an enormous contemporary resonance as an anti-war novel, in which we get inside what is supposed to have been one of the great all-time idealistic battles, and see that it was fought for all kinds of reasons, that there was a complete failure of idealism on all sides. I'm thinking of the sort of northern relationship to the contrabands and that kind of moral failing there. And I'm wondering, has it been taken up as an anti-war novel? Have people seen it for those contemporary resonances?
I think some people have. Yeah. Certainly some critics have, you know, pointed to those elements in the book. But it was certainly, you know, I think it kind of reflected my learning curve a bit on the Civil War, you know, just, I mean, this novel happened in a way because I married a complete Civil War buff in the person of Tony Horwitz, and we'd been married for about 10 years before I found out the extent of his passion for this subject, because the first decade of our marriage was lived abroad and partly in the Middle East, where our concern was with more contemporary conflicts. And wasn't until we went to live in a small town in Virginia that I realized exactly what I had gotten into. There's this famous saying that the Civil War was fought in 10,000 places, and it soon became clear to me that almost all of them were within easy driving distance of our house, and that he intended that we would visit them all on multiple occasions. And I guess by osmosis, I found that I was picking up a lot of things that I had, you know, been interested in this even as a Sydney teenager, and I'd written one of my school essays on a very pompous topic. The object of war is a more perfect peace, discuss with relation to the American Civil War. But I had only read the abolitionist tracts and the wonderful, you know, the kind of this drive to right injustice, and to find out that Lincoln's army probably had you know, about as many genuine abolitionists in it as Jeff Davis's was a bit of a wake-up call to me. And I deliberately put Mr. March in the middle of some of the morally questionable things that the North did, in terms of contraband was the word that the Union came up with for the slaves that fell within Union lines as the fighting moved south. And by the end of the war, that was 750,000 individuals. But before the Emancipation Proclamation, their status was very unclear because they were not yet free people. So how did the North deal with them? In some cases, wonderful, idealistic, free labor and education, the Sea Island Experiment, as it was called, was kind of the shining example. But then there were these terrible instances of negligence and outright cruelty, and particularly in the plantations that fell under Union control. And these were leased to northern carpetbaggers, essentially, who were encouraged to come down and lease these places for a year, make a quick dollar, and get out. And the contraband actually did worse under these regimes than they had under the Southern slave masters, because even though the Southern slave masters didn't see their slaves as anything but chattel, at least they were chattel that you had a big investment in and you tried to, you know, keep them healthy for your own self-interest, if nothing else. Whereas these guys had to make their profit in a year, so they literally worked people to death in some cases.
Do you have any... One of the things I've never understood, and I probably have always had the attitude you started with towards the Civil War, which is a kind of disengagement from it and not wanting to think a whole lot about it. I would definitely have to be dragged to what you call the sweaty reenactments. And I really started thinking about, you know, what you call Civil War bores, people who become fascinated with the Civil War. It does seem true that that war, more than any other, seems to attract a kind of passionate devotee. I mean, people who really will dress up in all of this gear in the middle of July and August, reenact these battles. Do you have any feeling about why that war, I mean, it finally drew you to? What does it, where's its pull?
It's everywhere. That's the thing. I mean, you find your own me under duress. You know, I eventually found I'm still bored to tears by battle order. Mm. I can't. I drive Tony crazy not being able to keep the chronology quite straight. But what fascinates me is the issues of individual conscience and how did people deal. And because the written record is so compelling, even the common soldier who was not particularly well educated would write the most astonishing letters that were just, you know, full of the most eloquent expression of what it means to be a human being. Mm. And how you find your best and worst self on a battlefield or in a crisis. And again, you know, having been somebody who covered contemporary conflicts, I knew that from my own personal experience, that you see everything that human nature has to offer. You see the most incredible acts of kindness and bravery and the most unspeakable kind of cruelty.
Mm. And there was a moment for you, I think, right, when you discovered something and it pulled you in and you actually connected to one of these young men. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my...
This is the talismanic moment, and yeah, I really want people to see this because it's incredibly moving.
Right, well, it's a Union soldier's belt buckle, and it was dug up in the courtyard of our house in Virginia. And it's right by what used to be the kitchen well that supplied the family's entire water supply. It's a beautiful hand-dug stone-lined well. And so this belt buckle was there, not very deep in the soil. And just, you know, it's one of those kind of transporting things, because I was holding it in my hand and wondering about the young man who'd worn it. And this town in Virginia, Waterford, was settled by Quakers in 1733. And so when the Civil War broke out, there was a huge issue of conscience for the young men of the town, because Quakers, of course, are pacifists, but they're also ardent abolitionists. And Waterford at that time had a very large free black population, which was unusual in Virginia, but this was one of the few towns where they were welcomed to settle. And so for the young men of the town, it was which is the greater evil, violence or slavery? And a number of them said slavery, and they formed a unit, which was the only unit in Virginia that fought on the Union side. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that our house had been occupied by a Quaker family at that time, and I wondered if the buckle had belonged to one of those young men. Mm. Who'd, it was a big step because they're actually read out of their meeting, which is a very tough thing to do. And then, of course, being Quakers, they were not very good fighters. So their military engagements were bloody and unsuccessful. So they didn't have a glorious war. So there was all that complexity to it. And I think, you know, it very much came out of a sense of place.
Mm. Once you found yourself pulled in, and you said, I guess I'm going to do this. I'm going to get involved. And I thought about this with Year of Wonders as, well, in both cases, you ended up writing the missing piece of a story. Year of Wonders having to reimagine what was it like to live through the consequences of that extraordinary moral decision. I gather there are very few records from the town. And March, of course, the absent father, the person who we don't know much about, the year we don't know very much about. Can you talk a little bit about your actual research process? What do you do to fill in those gaps? At what point do you feel like, now I know enough?
I always let the story drive the research rather than the other way around. Mm. So because I like to write in the first person, have a first-person narrator, getting the voice is everything. So I try and hear the voice in my head, and until I've got the voice, I can't start at all. And then, okay, so then once I can hear, and hearing the voice often has to do with, I think about something that a friend of mine, the English novelist Jim Crace, once told me. He wrote a book that's set in biblical times in Israel, and so to research that book he went camping in the desert, and he had a Bedouin guide, and the first morning they woke up and the Bedouin said, Mr. Jim, how did you sleep? And he said, I slept like a log. And then he raised his eyes to the bare rock-ribbed hillsides of Judea and realized that any log that might have been there was fed to a fire for fuel a millennium ago. So he turned to his guide and said, Ahmed, how did you sleep? And Ahmed said, Mr. Jim, I slept like a dead donkey. And so ever after he told me that, I've always thought about finding the voices is swapping logs for dead donkeys. And so that search for the texture of the language is important to me. And in Year of Wonders, it was the hunt for the Derbyshire dialect word that would give the narrative a sense of authenticity. And I say a sense of authenticity advisedly, because if I'd written the whole thing in archaic Derbyshire dialect, nobody would have ever read it. Yeah. with March, it was easier because I had Bronson Alcott's journals, and there couldn't be a more complete record of the inner life of an idealistic Victorian man, I guess. And so I could hear his voice very clearly. And I also had an excuse to read Emerson and Thoreau every morning just to sort of prime the pump and to get myself thinking in those Victorian cadences. So that's a big part. So then the story tells you what you need to know. And with March, I very quickly needed to know what was an early battle in the Civil War where Massachusetts troops would have been involved. And fortunately for me, that was Ball's Bluff, which was only 10 minutes away from where we were living. So I could go there and feel the press of the ghosts whenever I needed to. So I needed to know about that. Charles Frazier gave me a great piece of advice. He, of course, wrote one of my favorite novels of all time, Cold Mountain, and he said he's the kind of guy like me who loves libraries, who imagines heaven must be something like a library. And so he always said that, you know, he could get lost in the library for days on end, so he always rations himself, and he never lets himself go to the library until he needs to know at least three things. So I've tried [S2] Excellent. [S1] To use the Frazier rule But in Year of Wonders, the first thing I needed to know was how would a stable be laid out in 17th century, and what kind of books would clergymen have in their library? And lucky for me, there was a professor at Brown who'd just written a paper on what kind of books rural clergymen would have in their libraries in 17th century. So that was a banner day, because I do like to get the detail right. And I just spent last week, actually, in the Natural History Museum at Harvard trying to figure out, well, what kind of a moth would be in a high altitude above 2,000 feet in Eastern Europe.
And where would that go? Why would you? This is sort of the great segue to the question, so what are you working on now?
What I'm working on now is what I was working on when the idea for March struck me and sort of seduced me away for a little while, because I could just see so clearly how the book would be. Mm. And this book was not so clear to me at the time, but is much clearer now, I'm happy to say. And it's again based on a true story, and it's about a Hebrew manuscript that was created in 14th century Spain and still exists today by virtue of a number of remarkable rescues, one of which was from the Nazis during World War II, when a Muslim librarian smuggled the book away and hid it from the Nazis throughout the war at the risk of his own life.
That's great. Should we open it up and see if people have questions? Oh, does the new book have a title? Do you know its title yet?
It's called People of the Book. Uh-huh.
Other than Alcott's journals, Bronson Alcott's journals, did you do any other primary research?
Yeah, I did. I did. I spent a lot of time at Orchard House and at the Fruitlands Museum in Harvard, Massachusetts. And a tremendous amount of reading into Civil War letters and journals as well. And then there's this wonderful book that I found, which is an incredibly frank account by one of the northern carpetbaggers who went south, called from what was it called? From senior moment, but from something to do with the battlefield to cotton field, and this was it by a young man named Knox, who started his war as a war correspondent and then heard about this opportunity to make his fortune down south leasing a cotton plantation, and it went horribly wrong, and so he writes about this in a very unsparing and honest way.
Fruitlands was Alcott's utopia, right?
Fruitlands, yeah. I couldn't kind of wedge Fruitlands into Mr. March's life as much as I would have loved to. But for those of you who don't know about it, it was the most utopian utopia of them all. This was where Bronson took his family, and they were going to live on the fruits of the land in this absolutely gorgeous and spectacular piece of land that became a frozen wasteland with winds howling all the way across New Hampshire and hitting the house. And they lasted there about 7 months before they had to retreat, cold and hungry.
Did you read the description in the short story called Apple Slump?
I certainly did. And much to my delight, you know, Bronson gets a tremendously hard time from Louisa May's biographers for having subjected his family to this, but Louisa May writes it up in a wonderfully funny satire, and it's pretty unsparing, and talks about how unfortunately some call of the oversoul wafted all the men away right when the harvest was due. And Bronson, she gave the story to her father to read, and he said, Louisa, he praises the boldness and truthfulness of her strokes and says she's made the most of the material. So this was one of the great failures of his life, and yet he was so supportive of her artistically that he didn't mind, you know, being totally made fun of.
Well, I was struck when you said about when you're quoted as having written about how unkind the 20th century biographers have been towards him. And in that almost unblinking, very unsentimental look at him, it is honest without being particularly overtly kind or... I don't think the 20th century necessarily is unkind so much as they're simply honest about, you know, they called Emerson the seer of Concord and Alcott the seer sucker. Did you know
that? But actually, if you read Bronson's journal for the year when Emerson wrote Nature, many of the ideas that Emerson so eloquently was able to convey were ideas that he drew from Bronson's writing. Yeah.
Geraldine, I don't know who the you were referring to in the dedication of March, but just in thinking of what you've done in your life and your own kind of intrepidness, as that, you know, reviewer said, and thinking about your, you know, you're living abroad and what you've witnessed, what in your life or your childhood and your bringing up kind of gave you this empowerment? You know, you write about strong women. What do you think has been a source of your sort of fearlessness?
Oh, that would have to be my mother. She's a really remarkable person, and she gave me Little Women when I was 10 years old, and she said, read this, it's got great girl characters in it, but take it with a grain of salt, because nobody on earth is such a goody-goody as that mommy. And that was the kind of mom she was. And even though when I was young, she was very overprotective of me because I wasn't very healthy as a child, and so it was like, have you got your cardigan? Are you wearing a singlet? You know. As I grew up, she totally wanted us, my sister and myself, to be free to live our lives, and she was always kind of the wind in our sails. So when I would call her up and say, Mom, I'm about to raft across the Tigris River with some Kurdish guerrillas, she'd go, that sounds so exciting. Have a wonderful time. And have you got your cardigan? So she was just, she's really terrific. She convinced us that we could do anything, and we were sucked in.
Hi, I come from Derbyshire, so I've known Eve forever, and it gave me a lot of pleasure to see it written in your book. And so I know the setting is absolutely true, and I just wondered how you created the characters, whether it was just a leap into darkness based on the names of the people who were there at the time, or whether there was some other source document that you used.
Well, what we have on the written record from Eam is three letters from the rector's, I want to say, own hand, but they're not actually, because he dictated them because he didn't want to contaminate the paper. So he would meet at a certain point and sort of shout across the void to a colleague from the next parish who would take these down. So there's those three letters, and then there's all the wills, most of which he wrote because he was one of the very few literate people in this village of lead miners and shepherds. But the wills give you an incredibly clear sense of people's material lives because they actually listed every single thing they owned. So you get a very clear picture of people's physical setting. And then there's the anecdotal history that got written down 60, 80, 100 years later as the fame of this town and what had happened there spread. And so those are kind of, you feel like they're within living memory accounts. And from that, I drew a lot. The grave digger that got greedy and buried somebody alive, the guy who gets the idea that the plague is over because of the behavior of his cockerel, and So there are various people who are from the anecdotal history, but Anna is just suggested by a half line in one of the letters that the rector writes, and it's a very sad letter. It's right after his wife has died. And he says, "Fortunately, my maid continued in health, which was a blessing, for had she quailed, I would have been ill set." And so I tried to find out if there was any way to figure out who that maid had been, and there was nothing, not even a name, because nobody paid much attention to documenting the life of domestic servants. So I was free to imagine her, and I imagined her as the widow of a lead miner, because there were a number of widows, young widows in the town. And I put her right in the center of the action, because the legend is that the plague was carried from London on a bolt of infected cloth that an itinerant tailor had ordered. So I thought, where would he be staying? Well, he can be staying with Anna. Yeah.
I don't know if you can answer this question, mm-hmm. but besides your book, in the last few years, seem to be quite a few fiction and nonfiction books about the Civil War that I've heard about you know, the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth and Bleeding Blue and Gray, I think it is, about Civil War hospitals. And I just wondered if you had any sense, I mean, obviously your connection is so personal, but if you had any sense of, is there, and maybe you asked the question already, but is there something about the Civil War right now that's pressing to us, or is it just in the zeitgeist, literary zeitgeist, and if so, why?
I think that it's always thus with the Civil War. Tony, my husband, when he wrote his nonfiction book, Confederates in the Attic, actually did a bibliographical search, and I forget the exact number of titles that he came up with, but it was staggering. So you're thinking, why should I throw my grain into this crowded sandpit? But there's always another way to turn the glass and have a look at, you know, this experience. I mean, let's face it, March is not the only Civil War book last year called March.
I don't want to scare people away from the book. It's a novel I told a lot of people about this last year. Jumping straight into a battle scene really knocked me back. And similarly to the question about Derbyshire, I'm interested in what you absorbed from those ghosts whom you went to visit on that battle site. It was very intense and very vivid, as you realized it.
My editor actually said, "Yikes, you have to start with this." But I really did feel that you can't really address this. If you're going to talk about, you know, somebody at war, you have to deal with that. And the thing about that particular battle that's so moving to me when you go there is it's very much about topography, as so many battles are, and blunders, as so many battles are. And this is not a big deal battle. This is a very small engagement, and yet it's so dreadful in its detail. What happened, for those who don't know, is the Union really needed a victory after being whooped at Manassas, and they thought that they could make an easy strike on this little town called Leesburg, and they sent a scout to see how defended it was, and he mistook haystacks for tents because he was a city boy and he didn't know what a haystack looked like. And so he said, "We can go and take this. There's no guards around this encampment." And so at dawn, they poled across the Potomac River and they climbed up this escarpment to attack, not realizing that they were going to be flanked by guys coming through the woods who knew the territory, and guys coming from the front. So they're engaged from the front, and then suddenly they're completely flanked and they're pushed back to the river, and they've made no plan for getting out of there. And so they're all basically jumping, falling on each other, drowning, and it was just awful. So my editor was very unhappy. but I just think that and I don't leave him at the battlefront very long, because that's not what necessarily, you know, I was interested in him having, you know, the kind of experience that an idealistic northern clergyman might have had, and many of them did go into service with the contraband and the superintendent of the contraband, and that to me was much more interesting in terms of the moral quandaries that he would find himself in.
Thank you. I actually hadn't realized you were married to Tony Horowitz, and I love his book Blue Latitudes about one of my great heroes, Cook. And I just wondered, I hadn't realized you were Australian until tonight. So I guess I'm asking, I think Cook is a great hero, but he seemed to have left a trail of disaster behind him, having read your husband's book, and I just wondered what your feelings were about Captain Cook.
Well, this is how it works in marriage. We drag each other through each other's enthusiasms. So Tony brought me around on the Civil War, and I brought him around on Captain Cook. So Cook is a, you know, again, he's a bit like Bronson Alcott. He's a man who, if you look at him through the lens of his own time, appears very much one way, which is remarkable. But if you want to take, you know, 21st century post-colonialist sentiment and look at him through that scope, then suddenly the picture is very different. But I think that's unfair. I think you have to judge a man by the lights of his own time. And the thing that Cook did, I mean, he grew up in incredible poverty at sort of the bottom of the heap of a Yorkshire rural family, and yet managed to navigate huge swathes of the globe. And I think you can only liken what he did to arriving on another planet. You know, he went out in these very small, frail ships as far north as Unalaska, as far south as Antarctica, and just, you know, and the thing about Cook is, in his journals, he's a wonderful man of the Enlightenment. He never goes beyond what he sees. He never speculates. He just tells you what he observed. So he's a kind of perfect witness in a way. And I think he also was very insightful about the peoples that he encountered, particularly the Australian Aborigines, and unfortunately the people who followed in his wake didn't share his insight and his sensitivity, and that's the tragedy of the Pacific.
There actually is one more question that I wanted to ask, and one of the things that I was really struck by was that, having done so much work to recreate the voices of women and to give women their voice, that you made the leap in March to a male voice and to recreating a man's speaking voice. Was that a leap for you? Did you feel, I mean, obviously you make huge leaps, and foreignness in various ways is characteristic of everything you do, so it may not have felt to you like a leap, but of course there's always this sort of controversy about women speaking for men speaking for women, blacks speaking for whites. Did you feel you were making another leap, or did it just feel like a perfectly reasonable thing to do?
I think here it comes down to the question, same or different? Is the human heart essentially the same, or is it different? And when I used to be a reporter, I would always hear people say things like, the Palestinians, they're not like us, they don't love their kids, Israeli speaking. White South African about black South African, almost identical words. So this kind of idea that the other is some other kind of mentality that you can't know. Well, I would go from the Israeli house where somebody is keening for their kid blown up, you know, in a bombing, to the Gaza house where people are wailing for their kid shot in the riot, and the sound of the grief is exactly the same. And people would say to me, "You can't know." Mm-hmm. You can't understand an Eritrean village woman. Well, you know, I'm not in a different camp. I think that the things that shape our consciousness as human beings are wanting to live and see your children live, love, strong emotions, hatred, yes. And these are things that we all share no matter what our physical circumstances are, what the furniture's like in the room, even what gender you are. So I think if you basically believe that the human heart is the human heart, then it's not an impossible imaginative leap to attempt. I think I was emboldened by having Bronson Alcott's journals.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was a bit wobbly about how a man like this might have thought, there was something I could find to read that would give me some insight into.
So who's your anchoring voice in the next project?
Oh, well, that's a bit different. This is different in a number of ways. Year of Wonders and March are very, you know, they're very defined. They take place over a period of a year. And they're in one location, but People of the Book spans several centuries and a couple of continents, and it has one first-person narrator who is the book conservator, who is trying to get this book ready to go back on public display, and trying to solve some of the mysteries of where it's been all these years. And, you know, there are certain things in the action. I actually did sit with a book conservator who took this codex apart and put it back together and made it stable enough to go on display in Sarajevo, where it is a great symbol for the city of the survival of the multi-ethnic ideal. Because once again, it was a Muslim librarian who went in under intense shelling when the Serbs were trying to destroy the Bosnian National Museum and brought the book to safety. So, and it was saved in 1609 by a Jesuit priest. Why, we don't know, but we do know that he did save it. So a lot of hands have carried this book. So the voice is going to be the book conservator, but then it will go back in time to these various other people.
And you interestingly didn't answer the book conservator, male or female?
Female.
Just
Australian.
Curious. No, really. Very interesting.